This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Rikers Island is the biggest jail in North America. My guest, Andre Red Vaughn, has done time there twice. He's 21, and like many of the young people who have done time there, he's from a poor inner-city New York neighborhood. But he appears to be one of the lucky ones. After his second stint at Rikers, he found work that matters to him. He works with the group that helped him turn his life around, Friends of the Island Academy. It provides transitional support to young people who have just been released from Rikers. It was founded by the first principal of the prison high school and is devoted to breaking the cycle of crime and incarceration. We found out about Vaughn through Youth Portraits, a project that gives voice to young people who have gotten out of Rikers by helping them tell their own stories in short audio documentaries. Here's an excerpt of Vaughn's piece, which was co-produced by Youth Portraits director Stacey Abramson and David Miller.
What's up, y'all? This is Andre Vaughn, but most people call me Red because I have red hair. Actually, I had a lot of names in my life. This is the story of how I got those names and how I gave them up. I grew up in the Bronx. I didn't know my father at all, but my mom was like my best friend. She had her own name for me, Carrot Top. We were poor, but we had a close family until I turned 9. That's when my mom got addicted to drugs. My older sister Dawn was 14 years old when she figured it out. She walked in on my mom smoking crack.
She was in her bedroom. You know, you don't, when you're doing things, you don't hear a person coming. So I just opened the door and I saw her smoking the pipe. I stood there and she dropped in and she closed the door in my face. After that, it got worse. You get addicted to the drugs and you can't stop. So as much as she got addicted to the drugs, she forgot about her kids.
She used to be out all the time and we would literally like have to go around in the building to try to get somebody to give us food or something like that. I went to my uncle and told him, instead of him giving me the money, he took me on a robbery with him. It all started out with a phone call. He was like, listen, I got something for y'all down on 115th Street. It's a number spot, and we just left the house. It was like real work. Someone called us for something, and we went to work. We walked in. We never wore masks, because if you wear a mask, you look like you're about to do something. So he turned around and pulled out the gun and started patting the people down that was in there. So I came in, went under the desk. The money was stacked, so when I went to grab it, it fell over. So I'm in there picking up every dollar. So when we came out the building, I was standing there with my uncle because we never ran from the robbery. So we walking and a group of people was looking at us and they was coming after me and I wasn't going to let them get me. So I just shot into the crowd and ran. The first thing my uncle said to me, he talked to me like I speak to my bosses now whenever I do something right. He was like, yo, man, you handle yourself well. That's good. That's going to take you places. And I made a career out of it after that.
An excerpt of Andre Red Vaughn's Youth Portraits documentary. Youth Portraits is part of Sound Portraits Productions, whose work is often heard on NPR. We invited Vaughn to talk with us about his story. What did having a gun mean to you?
Everything. Because if anybody ever owned a gun or walked the streets with a gun, you know that it gives you like this kind of power where you feel like you're more powerful than anybody. And in some sense, you are, because you have a gun and most people don't walk the streets with guns. So, you know, it gave me this kind of power, especially like if I pulled it out on somebody or you know, like I said, I used to rob, like, you know, these big time guys. And for me to pull out a gun and see these dudes cower, and they just, you know, go into like this little shell. It gave me like this kind of rush. So, you know, to carry a gun was a big thing for me. It was important. I didn't leave the house without it.
Where would you keep it when you were walking the streets?
I had a holster, but then I lost the holster, so I used to just keep it in my waistband, in the front or in the back.
Did all your friends know what you were doing, that you were doing robberies, that you had a gun, and what did they think of it?
I didn't have any friends.
You didn't have any friends?
Nah, I just had my uncle. Gun was my friend.
So you weren't even a gang or anything?
Yeah, the first time I was incarcerated, I was in a gang. The second time I came home, I was not in a gang. But when I was in the gang, I didn't consider them as my friends either. In some weird kind of way, they was like my backup.
Right.
And, you know, I felt I was doing more for them than they was doing for me.
In the tape that you made, the tape of your own story, you said that you knew you'd eventually get caught or that someone would eventually shoot you, and you didn't expect to live long. How did you feel about the probability of dying young?
I mean, I knew with the life I was living, I knew it was going to happen. So, you know, it was just a matter of time on when it was going to happen. You know, I really didn't think too much about it, but I knew it was going to happen eventually.
And you just accepted that?
Yeah, because I wanted to live the life. So I accepted it.
Did you have friends who died when they were young while you were still living that life?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I didn't have too many friends, but there's a lot of guys that I knew.
Right.
And actually people that was friends before I started doing these things that were, you know, killed. A lot of them, a lot of the guys I knew was killed actually doing the same things I did. And, you know, it didn't change the way I was thinking. Actually, I learned from their mistakes.
What kind of robberies were you convicted of?
I wasn't convicted of a robbery.
Oh.
I never was caught for no robbery.
What were you caught for?
I was convicted of a gun charge. I got caught with a gun actually going to a robbery.
I see. What was your first time in prison?
My first, when I was young, like 13, 14, I used to do like little 90 days here, 30 days here for like petty larceny and stealing and things like that. But my first real long stint was I did a year on Rikers, and that was the gun charge.
Mm-hmm. Rikers Island is a penitentiary just off the coast of Manhattan, or off the coast of Queens, I guess I should say.
Yes, it's in East Elmhurst, Queens.
Yeah. Would you describe your first reaction that first time you walked into Rikers Island?
I was scared.
Of?
I was scared because I was out of my element. I mean, in all actuality, I was surrounded by people who were just like me, but I was out of my element because, you know, people feared me, people were scared. You know, actually, I thought it was respect. And once I got to jail, you know, everybody there was there for doing the same things I did. So, you know, I was just a regular guy again. And that's actually what I was scared of.
How much fighting was there within Rikers Island when you were there?
Man, a lot. I mean, a lot. I say I fought almost, if not every day, almost every other day. Because it's regular things, everyday things that you fight over.
Like what?
Like how right now, like how this morning when I wanted to get up and brush my teeth, I just went in the bathroom and brushed my teeth. On Rikers Island, you got to get up, and if someone, you know, your toothbrush might not even be there, someone else will take your toothbrush and, you know, sharpen it and turn it into a weapon, or someone will take your deodorant, or, you know, it's little things like that that you do on an everyday basis out here. It's something you had to fight over on Rikers Island.
And was each time somebody took your toothbrush or something like that, was that like a challenge? And unless you kind of confronted the person, you'd be seen as weak?
Yeah, because, you know, it's just like out here, man. They'll start with the little things, you know, and then it'll turn to big thing because they'll be stealing your toothbrush one morning or your deodorant, and the next day they'll be stealing your clothes, and the next day it'll be your phone time, and then it's your commissary. So if you don't nip it in the bud when it first start happening, then it's going to happen. It's going to continue to happen.
Is there anybody who could prevent that from happening?
I mean, the COs can prevent it from happening, but I don't, you know, they ain't too enthusiastic about doing that.
So what was the worst thing that happened to you in terms of one of these fights or one of these challenges?
I was cutting my back and I was cutting my arm.
Mm-hmm.
I was coming out of the commissary and someone, because actually this is when I had joined the gang, and I was blood. And we at Bloods have beef with Crips, Latin Kings, and, you know, mostly all other gangs. And a Latin King had asked me for my commissary when I came out the commissary room. And I told him no. And he went to snatch the bag. And I backed up from him. And I pulled out a razor first. And he spit a razor out of his mouth. And then he swung the razor. I put my arm up to block it. And he cut me on my arm. I swung the razor back. I cut him in his face. And that's when the CO started rushing out. And when the CO started rushing out, I ran, and one of the guys he was with cut me as I was running in the back.
After the fight, were you supposed to tell the authorities exactly what happened? And were there times when you did, or times when you didn't want to tell?
You never could tell. You never could tell because, I mean, on Rikers Island, it's like you, if you get known as a snitch, then you. And you're not going any place, so, you know, that just makes your time even harder.
Mm-hmm.
So it's either you handle it yourself or don't handle it at all.
Tell me what it was like when you got out. Like, where did you go after you were there for, what, a year?
Yeah. They, you know, I went, I went back to my sister's house. My sister was actually in a shelter. And I went to live with my uncle, the guy that had originally gave me the gun. I went to live with him. And we did the robberies a little bit more. But then I just was like, you know, I don't want to do this anymore because I didn't want to go back to jail. And my sister had moved out the shelter into an apartment. And I went to live with her. And she had her and a couple of my cousins and friends had told me about the mall upstate. I went up there and I had got a job at the store. And I was getting paid about $6.50 an hour. And I got paid like every 2 weeks. Every 2 weeks I brought home like $300. And it just wasn't me. I wasn't used to it, you know. In some weird way, I still had that criminal mentality. So what I started doing was I started taking credit card numbers, account numbers off the off people's credit cards, and taking them and making it. It's just another machine you have. You're just taking a copy of everything into this machine, and you can make a brand new credit card identical to the one that you had, identical to the one that you took the information off of, and you can use it. So I started doing that with a female up there. And I did that for a while, and I actually got caught for that, too.
And you went back to prison for that?
Yes, I did.
How much time?
They gave me another year.
At Rikers?
No, I was upstate. Actually, I thought I wanted to go back to Rikers because this is the place I was used to when it was close to home. But they didn't agree. They said if I did the crime up here, I had to do the time up here.
Was it different being in a prison outside of the inner city?
Yes, it was.
What was different?
Well, actually, for one, you know, the city guys was kind of like the enemy up there. So it was like I had like the whole jail against me, and there wasn't too many city guys in there. And I just like was out of my element. I didn't know what was going on around me. I didn't know nobody up there. My family, my friends is, you know, about an hour and a half away. It was just, you know, everything was just too different for me.
And I think you were arrested, you served time a total of 3 times, is that right?
Altogether. If you add up all the time I ever did it, it was up to 3 years.
Did you end up back at Rikers again?
Yes, I did. After I came home from the second bit, I ended up at Rikers again.
My guest is Andre Red Vaughn. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Andre Red Vaughn. After being incarcerated twice on Rikers Island, he's now working with Friends of the Island Academy, a group that provides transitional support to young people who have been released from Rikers. Can you figure out what it is that changed, that made you want to stop stealing and stop carrying a gun?
Over the time that I was incarcerated, I had like missed like so many things. I missed my nephew's birth. My sister was going through a lot of problems without me there. My mother had passed away, and like I said, I had met this girl named Ebony, and I really missed her. I wanted to be home with her. So when I got home, you know, I put all these things into play, and my sister was like, you know, we need you around the house. You can't leave like that. You know, you could keep going to jail. You're not helping at all. You're making things worse. When I came home, I laid in the house for about a year. Actually 14 months I laid in the house. You know, I didn't do anything. I just was there.
And then?
I went to like all of these different programs. You know, everybody's telling me, you stay out of trouble or you're going to be dead or in jail. And these are things I already knew. So I felt I didn't need the programs. And Ebony, my girlfriend, went to this guy in her church and spoke to him. And he invited me down to a program. And I went down to this program, and this was like the total opposite of all the programs I've ever been in. The atmosphere was different. And, you know, I felt it once I first like walked in there, because the guy that I met, his name was Mark Washington. And I was expecting some guy to come in with a suit on, you know, telling me about what college he went to and why he went there and what's going on. And, you know, and it didn't work out like that, because he came out and, you know, he was just dressed like me. He had braids, you know, he gave me a pound. And, you know, I was like, you know, this is different, you know. He wasn't too young, he was only like 25. So, you know, it was different. I saw myself in him, you know. I was able to relate to him more than I would relate to anybody else.
Now, you mentioned at the beginning of your tape that you had been very close to your mother until she became a crack addict. Now, I know she's since died. What happened? Did she die of an overdose?
No, even when my mother was a crackhead, I was still close to my mother. I was always close to my mother.
I see.
And She didn't die of an overdose. Dealing with the drugs had affected her kidneys, and actually she lost one, and she was on dialysis. And we knew that it was going to happen anyway, because the doctor didn't give her long. And, you know, we begged her to stop. You know, she tried, but she kept going back. And then finally she stopped. You know, we became family again. She started coming back into our lives. She met my nephews and everything, but it was, you know, too late because the drugs had already took a toll on her body.
Were you ever angry with your mother because she hadn't been able to take care of you when she became an addict?
I never was angry with my mother. My brothers and sisters had animosity towards her. They felt that, you know, it was her job. She's not doing her job, and she's doing this. But I never felt anger towards my mother, even when she was doing it.
How come you didn't?
Because that was my mother. I don't see how anybody could ever be, you know, or be angry toward their mother or have any kind of animosity toward their mother. I never did. I always loved my mother, even when she was on drugs.
Did you ever do crack yourself?
Never. I used to feel that at some point in time when my mother was doing it, I used to feel like something was wrong with me. I used to feel like something was wrong with me and everybody else that didn't do it because my mother was doing it. My mother was like this angel. She couldn't do no wrong in my eyes. So if she did something and everybody else didn't do it, I felt they was wrong. Or I used to feel, what's wrong with me? Why am I not doing it? But it never got to the point where I did it. And actually, after she died, I vowed to never, you know, touch it, sell it, anything.
So it was okay for you to carry a gun, but you wouldn't go to crack?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds crazy, but yeah. I vowed to myself never to sell crack, to touch it, to have any dealings with it. But it was okay for me to carry a gun.
Do you live in the same neighborhood now that you grew up in?
I still live in the Bronx. I don't live in the same neighborhood I grew up in, though.
Is it the same? Do you live in the same neighborhood now that you were living in when you started robbing?
No. I mean, I pass through there. I see people from there. And sometimes I go visit, but I don't live there anymore.
Is it good to be living in a different neighborhood so that you're not involved with the same people and they don't have certain expectations of you?
It really doesn't matter where I move, because it's somewhere, it's people doing what I do everywhere. It just matters now that I have to stay away from it. Even where I live now, I still see some of the people I did these things with. I run into people that I've did these things to, but it's just, you know, it's just how I distance myself from them.
Do any people from the old neighborhood make fun of you for going straight?
Yeah, all the time. They call me angel. They call me an angel. They ask me why I'm not out there getting money anymore. They say I changed. But, I mean, it doesn't matter now. I set my own standards.
Well, let me ask you about money. I'm sure you were making a lot more when you were robbing than you are now.
Yeah, definitely.
Give us a comparison of what you made then and what you're making now.
Well, back then I was, let's just say, you know, one robbery in 3 minutes, I could get $3,000 or $5,000. And now I would have to save up to get that kind of money.
What's the hardest part about living on your salary?
It's not really hard. It's just like sometimes, it's not really like my salary. It's just like being on my own, like without doing a crime now. You know, sometimes it get hard. Like I might get backed up in the bill or something. Or I might not have money to do what I want or to, you know, get certain things. But, you know, it's some of the stresses of the criminal life is gone. Like, you know, I don't have to worry. But like if the cops stop me, I can pull out my job ID and tell them where I got the money from. You know, I don't have to worry about them watching me. I don't have to worry about guys I robbed or anything coming back after me or want revenge. It's just like so many different things that I don't have to go through now, which makes this life much easier.
How do you feel about the police? Do you have strong feelings about the police one way or another? And do you ever feel like that they're your protectors?
I never felt like the police were my protectors, because every time I seen the police, they were doing something to me. Mm-hmm. Any contact I ever had with the police, they were doing something to me.
Of course, you were doing a lot of illegal things, and they were doing their job and doing something to you in a way, at least some of the time.
Yeah, some of the time. Some of the time it wasn't. It's just, you know, I don't have any feeling towards a cop. And I actually feel like they're the biggest gang in New York.
And you still feel that way?
Yes, I do.
Is it hard for you to stay out of trouble now?
No. No, it's not. When I first got with this program, it was kind of hard because I was still, like I said, I was in the neighborhood. And when the guys teased me and things like that, I felt bad, or I felt like, you know, in some weird way I was turning my back on them. But it's different now. I don't feel that way now. I didn't turn my back on them. I turned my back on the game. It's just that they're still in it.
Andre Redvoin is now a peer educator with Friends of the Island Academy and a teaching assistant for Youth Portraits Project. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Andre Redvoin. He served two sentences in New York's Rikers Island, the biggest jail in North America. Now at the age of 21, he works with the group that helped him when he was released, Friends of the Island Academy. It provides transitional support to young people who have just been released from Rikers. Now, I know you're working for Friends of the Island, the program that is for young people who've gotten out of Rikers Island Penitentiary. Have you had other jobs since you went straight?
No, I haven't.
If the point comes when you're looking for another job, are there things that you're worried about because you have a record? You know, are you worried that that no one will want to hire you?
Yeah. Actually, I've been on numerous interviews where I've seen them read down my application and everything is cool until they get to the part where it asks if I was ever convicted of a felony. And, like, their whole facial expression changed. These are things, like, I used to notice on an interview. And sometimes I'm afraid that if Friends wasn't there, I don't know what I'd be doing now.
Right.
Because I have two felonies, and before Friends, I didn't know anything about a job. Keeping one or anything. Like I said, the previous job that I did have, people got for me. And I wasn't able to handle it. So I don't know, you know, where I would be without Friends.
What kind of work do you think you'd want to do? I mean, do you want to keep what you're doing, the kind of counseling of young people who are in trouble?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely, because I feel like I have to give back. I mean, it's just the right thing to do. I mean, sometimes, you know, this is the wrong thing, this is the right thing. You know, it may not be what you always wanted to be in life, but it's the right thing to do. I'm giving back. I took from the community. I was just, you know, this monster in the community doing all of these things, taking away from my people, and it's like I got a chance to give back now, so why not give back?
You know, I think for everyone who's been a victim of a crime, you ask yourself, how can someone have done this to me and they don't even care? Like, it doesn't bother them that they hurt me. It doesn't bother them that they stole the money that I worked so hard for and that I really need. They don't care. How can they not care? Can you answer that question?
First of all, anybody who gets into who does crime or who gets into that kind of life, you know what you're doing wrong. So what you have to do is it's kind of like you block it all out. It's kind of like you just make yourself numb to all feelings because emotions and feelings is a weakness. You know, because you can't. How could you sell drugs to somebody if you feel bad for it? How could you rob somebody and take money from them if you're going to feel bad later? So it's kind of like just give yourself this numb feeling and not care what goes on.
So now that you're not robbing and you're not carrying a gun, do you still do that numbness thing?
Actually, I still get that rush and I still have that numb feeling, but it's like the total opposite now. That numb feeling I have is towards the people who still do it. And the rush I get now is from, like, if I do a presentation, and a little kid comes up to me and is like, you know, here's my number. Can you call me or can I talk to you and things like that? It's kind of like the same rush I used to get from pulling out a gun on somebody.
So it just sounds like such a complete difference to see emotions as being really weak. Emotions as a sign of weakness. It just must, like, be a really different life or change you a lot to, like, let in some of those emotions that you had to block out.
Well, actually, last year I was on the other side because last year I was mugged, I was robbed.
Oh, really?
And it kind of bugged me out because, like you said, I was on the other side of it, and I was like, you know, I had just got my paycheck, I just had my money, and it was like these guys just came up to me and, you know, they pulled out their gun, and I'm looking. First, they was young, so I'm looking at them like, you know, get out of here, get out of my face. You know, I did this, you know, way before you guys' time, and it's like, but. They was like me. They was persistent. They was not trying to hit me, not giving them the money. So they approached me with the guns, and I did what people used to do when I approached them. I gave them the money. You know, and it was hard for me to handle because I, the feeling I had was, you know, okay, I changed my life around. I'm not going to be this person anymore. I'm not going to be that person anymore, but I'm not going to be a victim neither. And, you know, I realized that when you're a victim, it's, you know, you're a victim. It's nothing you could do.
What did you do afterwards? Did you report it to the police? Did you try to go after them?
No. I don't deal with the police in any way. So I didn't call the police. The police saw what they didn't see what would happen, but they seen me. And they seen those guys, so they had figured that something happened. But they didn't go back for those guys. They came after me. And, you know, they asked me if I had ID. I didn't have any ID because the guys took my wallet. And, you know, they was kind of like, they was beefing with me. They had a problem with me because I didn't have any ID, you know. And it was like, you know, what happened? They thought it was a fight or something. And it wasn't.
So it was interesting to be on the other end, huh? To be on the victim end instead of the robbing end.
Yeah, I can't handle it.
You can't handle it? Is that what you said?
No, I can't. I mean, I handled it and I had to, but I pray that never happens again because I can't handle it.
Right. Well, one of the things you've done recently is a fellowship with Sound Portraits, which is a group that does real terrific stuff for public radio. And you've done like a mini documentary about your own story. It's like a narrative of your story, and you've interviewed some of the people in your life, like your sister and your girlfriend, for this tape. Just tell me a little bit about the process of actually reflecting on your life, especially after this long period of being numb, of not wanting to think too much. Now having to go back and really reflect on your life and think about it, tell the story of it. What was that process like, and what do you feel like you learned from it?
Well, I learned a lot. Besides like the technical stuff of how to edit and things like that, I learned a lot. I learned a lot from like my family because, you know, when I had the microphone, I put the microphone in, you know, my friends, my family, and my girlfriend, and things like that. They told more to the mic than they told me.
That's a really interesting phenomenon, isn't it?
I mean, it is, but it's true. You know, they told me, like, I found out how my sister really felt about my mother when she was on the drugs. You know, I found out how my brother really felt. I found out how Ebony felt when I was locked up, you know. She told me more about how her parents felt when I was locked up. You know, I just found out, like, so many different things. And it was a good experience for me because a lot of these things I didn't know. And if I wasn't doing this project, I probably would have never found out. They probably would have never brought up.
Well, Andre Vaughn, I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
No problem.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Andre Red Vaughn is now a peer educator with Friends of the Island Academy. We'll meet the assistant executive director after a break. If you'd like to hear more of Vaughn's audio documentary about his life and the audio documentaries of other young people who have been incarcerated on Rikers Island, you can listen on the website youthportraits.org. This is Fresh Air.